Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi. I'm your host for tonight. I'm a retired FBI supervisory special agent and profiler. I worked in the FBI for 22 years. Before that, I was a prosecutor in New York City. My specializations are in serial rape, serial homicide, child abductions, and child sex crimes. And with me tonight is...
Laura Richards, former New Scotland Yard, trained by New Scotland Yard as a criminal behavioural analyst and also by the FBI, by their behavioural analysis units, which is where I met Jim Clementi. I also have a master's in forensic and legal psychology, and my specialisms are in domestic violence, domestic homicide, stalking and predatory behaviour.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, where I met the fair Jim Clementi. And I am a I'm truly fascinated by true crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
So today we're on the continuing saga of the Netflix series Making a Murderer. What we're trying to do is drill down a little deeper than the documentary was able to do and look at the behavior of all the participants in this really bizarre case. So, part two.
Yep. When we last left off, where were we, Jim?
Well, we were talking about the evidence against Steve Avery and where it came from, mm-hmm. how reliable is it, how dodgy was the police behavior, what about the prosecutor's behavior, and so forth.
So we know that the police had to recuse themselves from investigating.
That's true, and that's a very rare circumstance. Have you ever heard that in Great Britain, Laura?
Well, I've seen a few cases where that has happened. And, you know, of course, a conflict of interest in this particular case is very clear. And mm-hmm. so it was very important that it was seen that another police department was investigating Stephen Avery for the second time.
Yeah, and the reason being that because the police department was involved not only as an organization, but the individuals who had been responsible for investigating and then convicting Stephen Avery in the first trial,
falsely
in which
convicting him, right?
He was falsely accused and falsely convicted. He was completely exonerated because they actually eventually caught the guy who actually did it. Because of that, there was a conflict of interest. And so they stayed out of, or were supposed to stay out of, the actual investigation.
Right. So these guys should have been completely not involved.
Yeah. You know? And what they should have done is, at least the main players, the people who were deposed in the Stephen Avery's lawsuit, they should have absolutely had nothing to do with the investigation. Instead, we found out something very different. And in fact, some of the key evidence was located by Detective Link and Officer Coburn, two of the people that were actually deposed in the Steve Avery civil lawsuit.
Now, who is it that's supposed to say, hey, don't send those guys? I mean, who is watching over this?
Well, certainly the chief of police should have, but he didn't. And then on top of that, the district attorney should have, but he didn't. And what happened was, on the third occasion where the house of Stephen Avery, which, let's face it, it was actually a trailer, mm-hmm. it's a small, enclosed space. I'm sure it was no more than, I don't know, 150 square feet or 200 square feet, maybe, if it was a double wide. But the fact is that it was a tiny space. It had been searched by their CSIs at least 2 days before this. And on the third day, they found these keys.
Can I ask you, just procedurally, when a place is searched and then it's considered clear, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody is signing off and saying, this is done. There's no reason to go back in.
Yeah, typically that's the case. And here's the other thing. A major issue, I think, in this case, a search warrant is meant for a particular date in a particular location. And when you get authorization to search a location, if you're not done within that prescribed date, you have to go back to a judge and get the search warrant extended. Or if it extends to other locations or other structures on that location. So I would really like to see what the history of this search warrant was, whether it was mainly, whether the property name was only Steve Avery's trailer, or whether it was the entire yard and all the housing and all the sheds and all the garages on that property. But if that wasn't all specified, I think it would be very easy it would have been very easy for a defense attorney to get any evidence found outside of that thrown out. So I suspect that they probably went back and with a lot more specificity named the locations and extended the dates of that search warrant.
Laura?
Well, I mean, you know, I agree with what Jim's saying on a search warrant. But I think it's certainly interesting that when you think that Lenk and Colburn were specifically told to stay away, they were the orders that were given. So actually, did someone senior sign off for them to be there, or did they just take it upon themselves to go there? And then, of course, seeing the footage of them being in the trailer and then happening upon this key that, you know, was in plain sight. And, you know, clearly they'd said that they'd picked up this cabinet, and just Jim and I discussed even the manhandling of this cabinet, how it could even be possible that it fell out in the way that they described. Mm-hmm. And certainly the same with the garage, you know, very interesting that casing is found in the garage when previously, you know, you would think that it has been signed off and cleared as an area.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's another thing. When we start with the cabinet, it was very... I didn't think very reliable or honest testimony when Colburn said, I'll be the first one to admit that I really manhandled that cabinet. The problem with that is that you could see before and after pictures.
Right.
And the before picture was very clear that right by the outlet, right under the outlet on the floor was a pair of slippers. And that was right next to the cabinet. The cabinet is in exactly the same position when they took the after picture. Now the slippers have moved, but now there's a key on the carpeted floor.
And in plain sight as well.
In plain sight at this point. And then you look at the bottom of the cabinet, and there are vertical dividers in that, and there are three sections. And in all three of those sections, there are books and papers that have not been disturbed. And if somebody had violently manipulated that cabinet, those things should have fallen out, and they didn't. Mm-hmm. So it tells me that that's not exactly what happened. It's something that a defense attorney should have driven a truck through, that argument. It seems like that was disingenuous testimony on the part of Colburn, and it's really unusual that after these same guys, this is the third day they are searching, and apparently there's a number of other days that this same location was searched, and it should have been searched once,
right?
And then it should have been sent back, let back to the family, and cleared so the family could go back to their location. And it wasn't done. So it's very suspicious.
Right.
Is it possible? Is it within the realm of possibility? Yeah, it's possible that they legitimately found that key that third day, that it fell out of the back of the cabinet. But I think the probability of that is close to zero.
Okay, so if they didn't find the key, so then, you know, you'd say that they put it there.
Yeah.
Where did they get it? Well, I mean, then you have to, you know,
well,
reverse
the
engineer the whole.
Yeah. And exactly. Of course, the key had Avery's DNA on it as well.
Well, not the key itself, but I think on the strap that attached to the key. But here's the thing. It was not the key that was depicted in a picture of
exactly,
her.
Exactly. Yeah, I saw that recently too.
Yeah, that it actually, she had a keychain that had a number of different keys on it. And that was not the only key, but yet that's the only key that was on this this key fob that was found in her.
Isn't it true that they didn't even find her DNA on the key?
It's correct, and that would have been incredibly difficult. It's just not. It would mean that somebody completely cleaned the key and then held it himself. That Avery cleaned the key completely and then held it himself.
Right.
Which would make no sense at all, right. Of course.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's possible, but not probable.
Right.
And it's also possible that he decided the only key I don't need her home keys or whatever, so he threw those away or whatever. But, again, it's just an inconsistency that we noted in the forensic evidence here.
Okay. And the other evidence, then?
Well, as Laura mentioned, the bullet that was actually found in the garage, it was actually found about 4 months after the original searches, and this was after Brendan Dassey had made a, quote, confession. The day before that bullet was found, guess who was back in that garage? Detective Lenk. Now, he had done a search.
Lieutenant, I think he was at the time, wasn't he?
At the time, he very well could have been. But he was back in that garage, and then the next day, this bullet was found. Now, he didn't find it when he was there, apparently. And is it possible that he placed it there? Yeah, it's possible. But it's also possible that that bullet has absolutely nothing to do with this case. Mm. The DNA test that placed the victim's DNA on that bullet was actually invalidated because the testee, the tester, the scientist who actually tested that bullet for DNA, put it in a basic solution and then tested that for her DNA. Well, the tester, her DNA was also was on the control for that.
Right. And she admitted to this whole.
Yes. Yeah. And she said it's the first time in the history of her career that she did not follow procedure and invalidate that test. She should have said this test is inconclusive and done it again. If she didn't have any more material, well, that's just a test you can't do. So scientifically, that test is invalidated. It should never have come into evidence.
And that's exactly what she said, that she'd use the full sample in this particular case, but she would never normally do that. And I think the other interesting point was that there was never a suggestion that Teresa Holbeck was actually shot in that garage. So it seems very peculiar that then a bullet is found within the garage where there's no other trace of Teresa Holbeck in there.
Hmm. Now, there is one thing that there was a big thing in the show that was made of the fact that she didn't find anybody else's DNA other than Stephen Avery's in that garage. There is a report that Brendan Dassey told his mother that the bleach stains on his pants came from him, Brendan, helping Steve Avery clean up the garage. And that would, that could account for a the lack of the victim's DNA, but only if it was very localized. In other words, if she had bled heavily, like from having her throat slashed or from being shot in the head, for example, there would have been a large amount of blood on the floor, and that would have been very difficult to clear up totally, especially shooting. If she was shot in that garage, what happens when somebody is shot is that you get high-velocity blood spatter, and that's basically sprays out little tiny, almost microscopic dots of blood. And that's because of the viscosity of blood itself, that it can only get very small when it's high-velocity blood. And because it's high-velocity, it sprays at quite a distance from where the wound is. And I would expect there to be blood that you cannot see with the naked eye, but you would still be able to get DNA from.
Right.
And we didn't find any of that in the garage.
And can't you tell when somebody's tried to bleach away a crime? I mean, there must be evidence of that.
Yeah, there could be evidence of that. If you go back to the Meredith Kircher case in Perugia, that case, clearly there was wipe marks on the floor where somebody took a towel, and it turns out it was the offender who took a towel and tried to clean the floor. But you could see when you used a substance, which I can't remember.
And just so that's the Amanda Knox case.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's Meredith Kircher, but
yes,
Amanda
sorry.
Knox.
But for those of you who don't know, that's the case where Amanda Knox was accused of murdering her roommate.
Yes. And so there are substances you can use that will highlight trace amounts of blood on a floor, and you would normally see that in a case where somebody tries to clean up a bloody mess. I don't think there was a bloody mess on the garage floor because it was too pristine. And although there may have been drops of blood there, I don't believe that she was killed in that garage.
Okay. Laura, anything?
Well, I guess only that, you know, if we take Brendan's account, as in the account that comes from a long, intensive period with investigators and also with his own defence investigator, where he is eventually asked to give an account about Teresa being tied to a bed in the trailer. So she's never actually placed within the garage itself. But I think it's an interesting thing, you know, again, that if that were the case in terms of what Brendan had said, why was the bedding, et cetera, not submitted to the lab for any of the forensic tests? So there's clearly lots of questions just about, you know, the evidence that was found and also why in the decision making certain other things weren't done. Mm-hmm. When we think about how crime scenes are forensicated, you know, and how long teams send in there, and what they're looking for is trying to gather as much evidence as possible and make sure it's submitted to the lab to be worked on. So we do know that from Brendan's first account, the very first time he's interviewed at the school, he does talk about being in that garage and helping his uncle clear up and, you know, having bleach all over his trousers. And, you know, he gives a different account right at the start to what he eventually says.
So the car, that's a big, that is a big piece of evidence to find on somebody's property.
Yeah, and how it was found is a little strange. And it could be serendipity, or it could be somebody basically told the woman who did find it where to look. I don't know. There are some circumstances surrounding that the finding of the car that were a little difficult for me to really accept. The fact that Coburn, one of the police officers who was named in the lawsuit, one of the police officers who testified in the trial against Avery, actually had called in 2 days earlier to the dispatch, called in with his phone, not over the radio, but called in and asked and basically ran the plate numbers and was told by dispatch, yes, that's the plate for the missing girl's car. And he said, a 99 Toyota, right? And she said, yes. So it sounds to me like he was standing there looking at that car with those plates on it. And that would have been impossible if the car was on Steve Avery's lot at the time. So it's a
Why would it be impossible?
Because he was not at Steve Avery's
lot
at
the time.
When he called it in.
Oh.
So that's obviously an issue. It's an inconsistency in the forensic evidence that is out there, and it needs to be explained. When he was asked that on the stand, he could not explain that. Colbert could not explain that. So when the when they organized a search party and this woman came
it's
to the lot
aunt, Pam,
with
Pam Sturm.
Right, with 3,000 or 4,000 cars, she spends 15 minutes going down one row of cars, and then all of a sudden she finds the actual victim's car. What do you think about that, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was actually 30 minutes. She got there about 10 o'clock and then managed to, you know, happened upon this car. When you look at the scale of that salvage yard, it is pretty big. So is that just fortuitous, or did they actually know where to look? I mean, it certainly felt at odds with me or for me in terms of seeing how that came about, because, you know, they could have been there for days. And she actually said that that she would have been willing, when she testified, she would have been willing to search that salvage yard, you know, for days if they hadn't have found it. But it certainly seems to be an incredibly good piece of luck, which she explained away as being a sign, you know, that Teresa was leading her there, as it were.
Yeah, it bumped on it too. But when I think, I mean, I'm not an expert in much, but I am an expert in people acting. And when I think about the recording of her finding it, I mean, I found it very believable. It felt like if she's acting like she's found it, then she deserves an Oscar, because I found it all, I just found it to ring true. Now, maybe she was pushed in the right direction to find it, and she did, but
I had a very different feeling, actually. Yeah, when I was listening to that particular call, I actually wrote in my notes, it's very peculiar that she's asking questions.
She's demanding
to know whether it is the car in question or not. You know, she wants that verified. And it just seems to be that she's pushing, you know, in a very, you know, demanding way to get that verification that it is in fact Teresa's car. So actually it didn't sound right to me in terms of the way that it was called in.
Especially since we at least observed in the documentary where all the searchers were warned, if you find something of evidentiary value, step away, call the police. That's it. Do not touch it. Do not get involved at all. Yet she was kind of really pushing dispatch to tell her whether or not it was actually her car. So it was a little weird, but again, we don't know, and it's difficult to say whether or not somebody actually pushed her in that direction or not. Mm-hmm. But they found the car there. It was very shabbily covered with some things leaning against it, some branches on it, which is out of the ordinary for that car lot anyway. Mm-hmm. So it really made it stand out rather than hiding
right.
it. But then we should get to the blood evidence and evidence that's found on the car.
Mm-hmm.
And right near the key, the ignition, there was some blood smeared, and it turned out to be Stephen Avery's blood. And there was another drop of blood on the door step, and that again turned out to be Steve Avery's blood.
And then her blood was found in the boot.
In the back of the car, yeah, in the hatchback part of this SUV.
And Avery's blood was under the hood as well of the car.
Well, I don't think it was his blood, actually. Mm-hmm. It was his DNA, but it was found, and it was found on the hood latch of the car. And that's something that you would have to use to open up the hood. And important detail, the battery had been disconnected. When I first heard that the car was found there, I thought the only reason why he might keep it there is that this is not a rich man at this point. Mm-hmm. This is somebody who may win a lawsuit. That's all theoretical at this point. But cars are a commodity to him. And a car that's in running condition and a good-looking vehicle, to him means money. And I think that if he was actually guilty of killing this person, that he may have said, I don't want to get rid of this car. I could sell it down the road. Or I can chop it up for parts and sell it for even more. I think it's the kind of thing that somebody who else would take the battery, disconnect the battery, other than somebody who was actually concerned about being able to start that car again and drive it off again. Because if you keep the battery connected and it just sits there, it'll eventually just wear out the battery and it'll die. But by disconnecting it, the battery will actually last longer.
I don't know. I got to tell you, that sounds insane. I mean, it sounds...
No, it's not insane.
For me, it's like if you're murdering somebody and people are searching for this car, by the own profiling that you've done, that I've heard you do, you want to get rid of the evidence.
But where's a good place to hide a car? You hide it in plain sight. He's got a salvage yard. You know, as I said right from the start, searching that yard could have taken days. So sometimes people think the best way to hide something is place it in plain sight. So an attempt was made to put things over it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, bearing in mind, and I'm just offering this up, that it could be the mentality that lightning doesn't strike twice. And that's what he might be thinking. Certainly, you know, I've seen offenders do that. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to remember that people under stress or duress aren't always operating, you know, mentally in terms of their decision making. In the clear way that we are sat here with none of those stressors on us thinking these things through. Yeah. But then there's the other side where why not just, you know, incinerate it, crush it, you know, get rid of it.
Right.
So, you know, I'd written both of those things in my notes, actually.
Okay, so I'm not crazy, Jim.
No, I'm not saying you're crazy. but I'm saying that this behavior is more thrifty than it is crazy.
Okay. I mean, it could be, or it could, or it could just be.
Yeah,
I'm not so sure. It could just be reckless behavior in many senses that, you know, he decides to hide it in plain sight, and maybe he does decide, you know, that he thinks that he's going to sell certain bits, etc. But it's certainly pretty reckless if it is him.
Okay.
But go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, equally, we know that the last time that she is seen alive is actually at his yard too, so.
That's pretty reckless behavior if you're going to kill her.
Exactly.
Right.
So, you know, and he had called the office, the Auto Trader office. So there's a very clear audit trail of him calling. I believe it was actually three times he had called, not just the office, but also her cell. And he had tried to hide his caller ID on her
cell phone. And how do we know that he tried to hide it?
They have a record of him dialing *67, which prevents them from seeing the source of the call.
So they have a record that it was him and not one of his brothers who also used to call her. I mean, call the Auto Trader.
Yeah, from his cell phone, that's all we know.
Mm-hmm.
But this leads us to the next piece of evidence, which is the blood that was found. Now, when they made a big deal in the documentary about how when they searched the case file, they found a styrofoam case with the blood vial from Stephen Avery in it. And they made a big thing about the fact that the evidence tape was cut on that, broken. And also, when they opened it up, they found that there was a hole in the top of the blood tube. Well, you may not know this, but the way that those blood tubes are filled is by piercing them with a wide bore needle. Mm-hmm. And it's a cuff that fits over the tube. The tube slips into this cuff with a needle at the end of it. It pierces the top. And it's a vacuum tube,
right?
So it actually has no air in it, and it sucks in the blood that's attached from the tube that's attached to your arm. So that's absolutely normal. And every single one of those tubes is filled that way, and that that's absolutely forensically normal. However, the tape on the outside, the breaking of the tape is actually done when the lab tests that blood, when they run his first DNA profile or do whatever drug tests or whatever on that blood. So the tape is normally broken. But after that, the lab person or a detective who is witnessing the lab test should put new evidence tape over the old broken one or next to it and then re-sign and redate it. Yeah. That's proper procedure.
Right.
So the fact that this was not done actually broke the chain of custody of that evidence.
Right.
And it should invalidate any evidence that
really?
Was taken out of there. Yes.
Really?
And I think any defense attorney who knew what the hell they were doing would have had that blood evidence thrown out because of that.
Well, they tried. I mean, it looks like they tried.
I don't know how hard they tried, but I think that that actually is a, it's just a violation, an absolute violation
right.
of the chain of custody. And hell, that would not stand up in the Southern District of New York in federal court. Let me just put it that way.
What about you, Laura? Would that stand up?
Well, it wouldn't stand out, but I thought what was interesting, I certainly asked Jim the question about the vial and seeing that hole, because the whole way it was portrayed, mm-hmm. you know, they actually portrayed it as this is a major breakthrough in the case. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I watched it, I was actually, you know, of the mind in that moment that his blood had absolutely been taken from that vial because mm-hmm. the way that it was presented. So I think it's important that you do hear both sides, you know, to how that blood is taken. And of course, there were further tests that were then run by the FBI, and they found that it probably wasn't the blood that was taken from the vial that was found in the car.
Right.
Is that any controversy?
Well,
though?
Yeah, there's some controversy about that. But let me step back to what Laura was saying. It doesn't mean because the tape wasn't reapplied, we can't prove that they didn't get it out of that vial.
Right.
But the FBI did a test, performed a test on the blood samples, 3 of the 6 blood samples that were taken from that car, and they said the test did not find any evidence of the preservative that is found in that blood tube. However, if this preservative had been found, that would probably be a very determinative test.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it wasn't found could just mean that the levels of that preservative were so low
right.
that it didn't actually show up in this FBI test. Now, I know Mark LeBeau, who was actually the head of the chemistry department who testified in this trial, and I know he's not going to get involved in doing something illegal
right.
to help cover up for other cops,
sure.
whether he knows them or not. But I think, so legitimately, I think he believes that that test was accurate. I don't know, though, what their control level was. And I think that's something that a defense attorney should do a deep dive on and really try to determine what the levels of positive finding or negative finding of that preservative would actually be for that test.
And we already know that this, the woman who was handling the blood for all these tests, that she had made mistakes. And I mean, is it possible that she didn't have enough of this preservative, or what? I don't know what the procedure is.
Well, the preservative would be a
culture stuff.
The question would be whether or not an air dried sample, a small sample of that blood that came from that tube, would have a sufficient amount of that preservative in it to actually show up on this test.
So that's the EDTA, isn't
yes.
it, we're talking about?
And if you don't do a test to determine whether or not an air-dried sample of a small amount of that blood, a small smear of that blood on a plastic surface would actually retain all of its EDTA, whether it didn't break down over time,
right.
whether the light shining on it didn't erode the EDTA molecules and they wouldn't be detectable anymore. There's a lot of things
to
be done to determine whether or not that test is valid, and I don't know if they did it in the number of weeks that they had to create this test.
Moving on to
the bones.
The bones.
I think the victim's bones in the burn pit behind Stephen Avery's house, as well as in a burn barrel across the yard at the Dassey's house,
mm-hmm.
as well as in a gravel pit at the far end of their property, are the most disturbing pieces of evidence in this case. Now, is it possible to completely destroy human remains? Not really. It's very, very difficult to do that. So complete human remains destruction is a very difficult thing to do. To get this level of burning that was accomplished on these bones that were found in Steve Avery's burn pit would have required hours and hours of burning with a lot of fuel. And fuel being gasoline, kerosene, wood, tires, those kinds of things, to keep a fire going for a number of hours. So it would have taken many hours to actually accomplish what was done here. Human remains, the destruction of human remains, can really only be accomplished in a crematorium. And that is with really high temperatures directed directly at the body for a number of hours. Otherwise, you will get pieces of bone fragment and so forth. Even in the ashes that people collect from their loved ones, there are bone fragments left over. And frequently, you can get DNA from those bone fragments. But in this case, it was not accomplished to a great degree. It was certainly a high degree of destruction, but not completely. And they were able to find just about every pieces of just about every bone of her body in that burn pit. Now, there was additional bones, burnt bones from her body in the burn barrel across the yard at the Dasseys, and then in the gravel pit. And try to understand what actually happened here. And the defense made a big argument about the fact that we know that bones were moved. Mm-hmm. We know that as a fact because they were in three different locations and most bodies are in one place. However, they don't know whether or not the body was separated. Those parts of the body were separated and burned separately.
Oh, God.
It could have happened. I know it's a horrible thing. It's also possible that when the big fire went out, that they found part of her body that was not yet completely consumed, and they put it in a burn barrel.
What is a burn barrel? I don't live on a farm.
Okay.
I don't know what it is.
Typically, it's a 50-gallon drum that is used to just burn garbage. And so it's basically they punch a couple holes in the bottom so air can come up through it, and they light a fire, they pour gasoline on garbage, and they burn their garbage. And that's called a burn barrel. So if after the fact, after the original fire had gone out, they found some of the remains, they may have then put it in a burn barrel, poured some gasoline over it, and tried to burn it even the rest of it.
Did they find that accelerant on it? Or I don't know.
Well, it's hard to distinguish between that accelerant being used for months and months and months and years before that and just at that point.
Got it.
So, and then maybe after that, that barrel was taken to the gravel pit and dumped there. And that is why the bones were found in three different locations. I think that's my best theory about what happened. What do you think, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, they can't rule out, you know, other burn sites or another burn site. He certainly had an incinerator there. So, you know, a question mark for me is why not use an incinerator? But yes, I mean, bone fragments, teeth were found, but also some of her personal possessions.
Right.
I think the phone was found.
The cell phone and the purse. Or the camera.
And the camera as well. So, you know, it's interesting. One of the sites where they found is right outside his bedroom window. You know, how do you create or how do people plant a crime scene like that, you know, in different sites on somebody's property, you know, was a question running through my mind. And then obviously there's the whole question about no systematic approach to evidence collection and excavation. They didn't have a forensic archaeological approach, which would be absolutely key in a case like this.
It should have, yeah.
What is...
What that would mean is instead of going in with shovels, digging out the burn pit, throwing it into wheelbarrows, traveling to another location, dumping all that stuff out, screening it all out, and finding the bone fragments that are left there, they should have actually been in that pit with little brushes and little hand trowels, and they should have excavated that site, and they should have documented every single layer that they took off. They should have photographed it the whole way. They did none of that.
And it's painfully, excruciatingly slow, but it's part of a forensic archaeological strategy to do that. And then they can work out the ground disturbance. There's lots of information that other experts can draw out about the actual site itself that tells you a whole bunch more. But in this case, that didn't happen. And they just used shovels, literally just shoveling out the remains.
So they had an opportunity to determine whether or not this was a primary disposal site or whether it was a secondary or tertiary site, and they threw that away by doing it the way they did it.
And do you think that's through ignorance, that they just don't Most have likely. Those kind of...
Lack of sophistication. I don't know that they had that level of expertise in their crime scene analysis. Mm. But I also think that it's, you back up, that it's an indication that the offender didn't have a high level of criminal sophistication. Yes, he had some. Whoever did this had some criminal sophistication. He tried to get rid of and almost got rid of this body, but not completely. And so that tells me it's somebody who had some experience who didn't necessarily have the highest intelligence level.
Hmm.
But in terms of the police investigation and in terms of the evidence, obviously there are some very big problems with the way that they adduced, you know, and captured that particular evidence that, of course, was questioned in court.
So is there any other evidence Yes. that we haven't covered before we get to that? Okay.
One issue I want to talk about that people are discussing is reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. Now, the jury was privy to all the evidence that was presented in this case, not necessarily all the evidence in this case, but what was presented at the trial. And they made a determination that there was no reasonable doubt of his guilt.
Right.
They found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. People are talking about that issue, and they're saying there's plenty of reasonable doubt in this case. The fact is, that's the one thing that we can't overrule. We can't change that. The jury was convinced in that trial. Reasonable doubt is not the issue here. The issue is actually whether or not Steve Avery got a fair trial. And that is something that can be legally reviewed and reviewed in an appeal.
Mm.
That is the only thing that could save him from his life in prison or get him a new trial. Because if he was not given his constitutional rights during the course of that investigation or during the course of that trial, then he may have another chance in federal court. A habeas corpus petition has been filed, and the federal courts will review that and determine whether or not they can move forward with that habeas petition. The only problem is the time for that petition has certainly lapsed. They would have to get, the federal government would have to get an agreement from the state of Wisconsin to waive the time. And they can do that. Mm-hmm. They've done it in other cases. Or they could say, no, we're not going to review this at all. We're not going to let you review it because the time has lapsed to make that kind of an argument.
Okay.
I was just going to say, you know, going back to the question of evidence, you know, we can't forget the fact that she was last seen alive up at the Avery salvage yard. And I think that placement, you know, in terms of that's where she was seen, she had an appointment there, she was the photographer, and he would always call up Auto Trader requesting her specifically. Well, you could argue that actually she's the only photographer with, you know, within Auto Trader, so he's going to be calling her by her first name. But there was other information that he had called her numerous times on that last day, three times, mm-hmm. and that she had also made a complaint to her boss that he was always inappropriate towards her. So
is that exactly what was said? I don't recall that.
She said that he entered the door one time in a
towel. Right.
Yeah.
Yes, and she felt creeped out by him.
Right.
So I think there are some other things, of course, that we didn't see through the documentary itself, mm-hmm. but there mm-hmm. is other evidence that I'm sure Ken Kratz and others, because it was all of these things put before the court, in terms of, you know, the evidence that was adduced against Stephen Avery. Mm-hmm. So those things are equally as important as well as the forensic evidence, although, of course, as we have discussed, there are some major challenges with the forensic evidence, the physical evidence itself.
And let's just talk a little bit about this. Her cell phone and her camera were also found burnt in that fire pit and burn barrel.
Right.
And so that is an important piece of evidence. Did they determine whether or not that cell phone ever left that property?
Mm.
I don't know. I never heard anything about it
can
in
they?
The documentary.
Can
of course they can. If the cell phone is on and she left that property, it would ping on different cell towers. Each cell tower has three different directions,
mm-hmm.
120-degree arcs in three different directions. So you can actually tell from a cell phone which one of those arcs it hits, the direction that cell phone is when it pings to that tower. And in general, a cell phone will ping the local towers every 30 to 45 seconds while it's on. Just because you want to get your calls immediately. And the way that the cell system works is that it pings your phone. Your phone pings back to a tower every 30 or 45 seconds so that if a call is coming in, the cell system knows where you are, so it knows the fastest way to route it to you.
You know, I've heard a lot about cell phone pinging from the Serial podcast and from Undisclosed, so I am not an expert in this. But isn't it true that if a cell tower is full, I guess you could say, if it's very, very busy, mm-hmm. then it could be a misdirection on where?
Well, if a cell tower is full, there's a lot of traffic, which mm-hmm. is not likely in this rural
right,
area.
Of course. Yeah.
But if there is, then another cell phone tower further away can mm-hmm. pick up that traffic. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it should still be in that directionality. In other mm-hmm. words, it shouldn't tell you that it's north instead of south. Mm. It should be the same. It should
gotcha.
Be aiming the same direction. So you should be able to tell if it's consistently in that area or if it had changed areas.
So currently we don't know if they ever did any kind
Correct.
Of.
We okay. don't.
Okay.
We don't. But if I was on the defense team, that's one of the things I'd be digging into.
And the last key points for me just around the evidence, because that's obviously what we were talking about, is the fact that obviously at the time that Teresa Holbach disappears, Stephen Avery is actually under investigation for mm-hmm. another sexual assault on a young teenager who I believe was a female relative. So that was a 2004 sexual assault. That's on record.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other reports. We have discussed that before mm-hmm. in terms of his previous behaviour, mm-hmm. the setting fire to the cat, the history of being sexually exposing himself, you know, indecent exposure to his cousin Sandra mm-hmm. and masturbating in front of mm-hmm. women. So, you know, I guess in terms of what the prosecution's case, where they were building a picture using mm-hmm. the physical evidence, but also, you know, form a bad character in terms
right.
of his behavior.
You know, and just to sort of take a left turn here, I mean, I would say that almost every male on that property had those similar allegations against them, had similar arrests. And
I think that's important to talk about because...
Well, bar Brendan Dassey, because actually Brendan Dassey was the only person who did not have, as far as I'm aware, mm-hmm. had no run-ins with the police. And
he's
actually
16 years old.
Was doing pretty well in terms of, you know, what he was doing. And
staying out of trouble.
Staying out of trouble, particularly
right.
given the surroundings that he
right.
found himself
but,
in.
But the uncles, the stepfathers, you know, there are so many people.
Yeah, apparently there were a lot of allegations of child sexual victimization, including against Brendan Dassey, that he was the victim of sexual
Stephen
victimization
Avery.
At the hands of Stephen Avery. This is something that was not only talked about in the documentary, but there was actually recordings where they played where where Brendan was talking to his mother, and he said, "I told them," meaning the investigators that were interrogating him, "I told them about Stephen touching me," and so forth.
And I remember this call and how she said, you mean when he was wrestling around and messing around with you? I mean, it's a little ambiguous on
What you're saying, though, is exactly what every defendant who has sexually victimized a child says. Inadvertent. That I didn't mean to.
No,
what's important is that the victim, the person who was being touched, said to law enforcement officers, mm-hmm. "I was touched sexually by this man," that's an adult, and they didn't investigate that.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't pursue it one iota, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's a failure of the mm-hmm. justice system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not he said anything at the time, it doesn't matter. Most victims will not disclose. The average length of time for a victim to disclose, 20 years.
Oh, yes.
20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he came forward in a very recent amount of time is actually, he's to be commended for that. The fact is that they should have investigated that as a crime as opposed to doing what they did to Brendan Dassey.
Right.
Exactly. And the pattern of behavior, just going back to the female
mm-hmm.
teenager,
mm-hmm.
What she also said was that Avery had threatened to kill her family if she had told anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So again, when we just think about coercion, you know, and threats being made that, you know, keep somebody's silence, you know, there is a question mark about how many other, you know, potential people are holding that secret
yeah.
In terms of Avery's behaviour. So, you know, you can put it in the context that everybody else around him is behaving in the same way, so it gets normed out.
Right.
I.e.
right.
this becomes normal behaviour. Mm-hmm. But of course it's not. These are criminal offences. Mm-hmm. These are young, vulnerable girls and boys that are being preyed on sexually. Mm-hmm. Some who are predators, you know, who choose those vulnerable people, but some of them are keeping the secret because they fear the repercussions and the consequences, which is what we know about why people keep that secret.
Well, that's all the time we have today for our second installment of Real Crime Profile. Next week, we're going to come back and talk about Brendan Dassey.
So before we sign off, Laura, I know you wanted to...
Yeah, I just wanted to make a very important point here, that whilst we and the nation are deliberating about... what's gone on, you know, was he guilty, that somebody has lost their life here.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
It's a really important point that we cannot miss. This is not about entertainment. Mm. I mean, for me, and I know, you know, I can speak for Jim on this, the search for the truth is a really important one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, honouring people's lives and learning from their deaths has been the 10A through all of my work. Mm-hmm. So for the Holbach family, they are still grieving. Right. And having everybody dissect and pick through what they think, or, you know, they think happened, their hypothesis. But, you know, this young woman was murdered, mm-hmm. and she has been taken forever. And I think it's still important that we do learn the lessons. And certainly, you know, when women are abused, I've set up a service in the UK, which is the only service for victims of stalking. Mm-hmm. Currently in the world. And, you know, there are those services out there, domestic violence, stalking, you know, that people can call. So I think there's a very serious undertone to this. It's not just about entertainment, mm-hmm. that, you know, I just wanted to make very clear.
Yeah. Thank you, Laura, for saying that. And I would, of course, absolutely join you in that we are at first most concerned about the victims of crime and trying to prevent crime.
That's right.
Why we study criminal behavior, to try to prevent offenders from continuing to offend.
Absolutely. Prevention is vital. And mm-hmm. I've spent certainly the last 15 years of my career around the prevention agenda, because at the time when you're profiling, it's very reactive in the sense that somebody's already died. And I spend a lot of my time working with victims who are still alive and trying to keep them alive. Mm. So, you know, if you have any questions about stalking or you're being stalked, please contact Paladin, the National Stalking Advocacy Service. It's in the UK currently. I'm hoping that we're going to set something up over here very soon.
Great. And can you spell that for us?
So Paladin is PALADIN. And you can look at the website, www.paladinservice.co.uk. And hopefully there will be a sister service soon in the US.
And you can follow Paladin on Twitter.
Yes, at Paladin Service. So please have a look at the website. Please follow it on Twitter, as well as Jim's Twitter feed and mine.
All right, well, that's all the time we have today for this second installment of Real Crime Profile. You can follow us at Real Crime Profile without the E at the end. So it's all one word, at RealCrimeProfil.
And where can people find you, Jim?
I'm at jimclementi.com and at Jim Clementi on Twitter. And my guests today are Laura Richards.
And you can find me on Twitter at LauraRichards99 and www.laurarichards.co.uk.
And Lisa Zambetti.
And you can't find me anywhere, but you can tune into Criminal Minds on CBS Wednesdays at
9 o'clock. All right, great. Take care. We'll see you again soon.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions.